Hey, it's Rob. It was an amazing week of Survivor, and we had incredible podcasts with Christian Hubicki and Steven on the Know-It-Alls. Make sure you catch those as well. Plus, The Circle was back this week with an AI contestant. Taryn, Mike Bloom, and Puya broke down the first week of drops from The Circle and on Renap. Who did Sam Moore find for the big guest? Find out on this week's Rob and Akiva Need a Podcast, all right here on RHAP. We know reality TV.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to RHAP's coverage of Global Survivor. I'm your host, Shannon Gust, here to do another off-season Game Theory podcast. The off-season continues on mercilessly, I would say. But we are here to talk about some really interesting stuff, and I am really excited that the Game Theory series has come out of the off-season because I think we've had some really rich analysis that we can definitely take forward into viewing and analyzing Survivor going forward. So to continue that on, I need to welcome in a man whose name you've heard many times on this podcast as the writer of the Chizzy theme song, the Biostrath Variety Hour theme song, and its updated counterpart coming soon to the Survivor South Africa Season 8 podcast. Very excited about that. And the International Survivor Hap-Hup theme song that you literally just heard. He's also a math genius, which is what's going to be relevant today. Please welcome the great Jacob Sager-Weinstein. Jacob, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thank you. I accept everything you said except the word genius. I will accept moderately competent instead.
I thought you might have an issue with that. But look, compared to me and maybe some of our listeners who might be as lost as I am, you definitely are a genius. We'll get into your credentials. You are definitely the person to talk to right now to talk about what we're going to be talking about, which is mathematical game theory principles. It sounds like a lot. We're going to break it down. We're going to make it fun. That is a promise we are giving to the listeners.
Absolutely. And as I'm going to try to keep this math podcast as number free as possible.
I love that. I mean, as someone who, you know, is counting the Chizzy charts in real time on the podcast sometimes and not always getting it correct, that's where my math kind of goes. So I dropped out of math in high school. I tried really hard. Like, math doesn't come easily to me. I tried really hard at math throughout school and then eventually just gave up on all of it. And I think I've lived a better life since. But the way to get me to learn about math is Survivor. That's how I get to do it. Hopefully the rest of the listeners feel the same.
Excellent. I think that then that's a good goal for today, is the sort of the Survivor will be the sugar that makes the math medicine go down.
Yes, that's exactly it. And you know what? They might not even realize that they're learning math. We'll just be talking Survivor. We're really making it sound good, aren't we? That you have to distract them from the content as we do the content. No, it's going to be great. We'll talk about what, you know, the actual content of the podcast will be. But before we do that, Jacob, other than being the jingle writer for our podcast, to the point where I told you, I said I was doing this podcast with you. My mom was like, Jacob Sager-Weinstein? That guy is famous because we mentioned your name so much on the podcast. But in terms of the math genius side of things, that I will say again, what are your credentials to come teach us math without us even knowing it today?
Okay, so many years ago, I won't say specifically how many, when I was an undergraduate in college, I was sort of torn between being a math major and an English major. So I pursued both tracks simultaneously and got fairly deep into math before I decided that I really prefer fields where you can just make up stuff whenever you want, which you almost can do in math, but you have to have some sort of basis for it. Whereas in writing, you just make it up whole cloth. So I mostly abandoned the math and switched to English and became a writer. But before I did that, I had studied, among other things, some game theory. I took a semester of game theory. I studied with a guy named John Conway, who is one of the greats of the field. But I want to be very careful on this. I don't want to be the Eladia Baldwin of game theory. So I want to be very honest about my own limitations. That this was, you know, this was like decades ago on an undergraduate level, and so I've retained the general theory of it. I've lost my ability to do a lot of these complex complications. I'm going to try to make it as simple and clear as possible. In doing so, I might oversimplify, but I hope not to be inaccurate. But I'm sure there are people out there who know more about this stuff than I do. You know, I would say I I know more about game theory than the average children's author, but less than the average member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So I'm somewhere in that middle range. And, you know, if I get anything wrong, I hope people will politely, but, you know, tell me on Twitter, let me know, because I want to be simple and fun, but I do want to be accurate.
You're going to regret saying that. I'm going to tell you what I'm an expert in, and that's just to tell you that you might regret inviting that in. But I'm going to take away your own modesty. You studied at Princeton, right? You studied math at Princeton. That's good enough for us here on the International Survivor Rehab Hub's feed. We are happy with that. But I think it is a good one because you are going to put it in layman's terms for me, for the listeners, so that we can understand it, which is important. I mean, we've been kind of talking about some of these concepts over the last few weeks, so I've done my own reading. It's still some complicated stuff. But again, you put it in survivor terms and it makes a lot of sense because it's like, why are we doing this is, I think, a reason, maybe something that we should get into. And I say we already touch on some of these principles in the analysis when I understand it, at least. Like, I think my excitement about how some versions of a 2-1-1 of a perfect prisoner's dilemma do kind of show that. And that's like a game theory principle that I understand and I know about. And I was like, hey, and I recognize that. And it just made me really excited. So if we can kind of start expanding on that with other principles, I think that's really fun. And contestants are thinking about this and we want to be able to analyze it. Like, for an example, Graham, who is on Survivor South Africa Season 5, which I'm currently covering, he evoked the idea of a zero-sum game in a recent tweet to explain his move. I didn't understand that. I didn't know what a zero-sum game was. In the course of this podcast, and in the course of researching it with you, I now do understand it, and hopefully our listeners will too. So it's important to kind of be able to analyze the game better. These are all the things with the Game Theory podcast, where we can analyze it better. If we ever are on the show, or our listeners are on the show, they can play better by factoring the stuff into their thinking. And as I think we found, which I can no longer deny, it helps you manipulate your loved ones. All right? We don't endorse it, but it's something that is happening. So I think for those reasons, there's a lot there in terms of like what people can really grab and have it enhance their viewing experience with Survivor.
Yes. And in fact, so game theory really exploded, that might be the wrong word, in the 1950s. Because it was useful to the Western world in analyzing the Cold War and figuring out what the Soviet Union was going to do and what moves you should make as a society and as a military. So this will not only help you manipulate your loved ones, help you win on Survivor, it will also help you defeat a massive global adversary over a decades-long Cold War. So if you've got any of those things planned, this is the podcast for you.
I've just been getting DMs about how people need help with that. So I think it's like really timeous and it's great that we're doing this. But yeah, I think that the audience we have here on the Game Theory series, it's a specific type of audience. Obviously, they're going into this knowing that what it's going to be about, that it is about mathematical game theory principles. That sounds like a lot. And I think our audience and a lot of Survivor superfans do want to use the show to kind of learn more about the world, to analyze things deeper, the way that we see it as chess on an island. And that's why so many people in the RHAP community enjoy the show. Like, how can we analyze that deeper and understand the game that much better? So I think people really are going to enjoy this.
I think so. And it does, you know, all joking aside, this stuff does have some value in daily life and helping you analyze your, you know, anything that you feel needs strategy or negotiation. Just like you can learn that from Survivor, I think you can learn that from game theory and apply it to your life as well.
Yes. Okay. Well, we have spent a long time convincing people why they will enjoy the podcast they have already pressed play on. Thank you for doing that. What we're going to be doing today is looking at four principles, mostly, with, you know, a lot of overlap. But the four that we're looking at are backwards induction, zero-sum games, as mentioned in Graham's tweet, Nash equilibrium, and multiple equilibriums. Please stop me at any point if I'm getting things wrong. I know that's going to sound a lot to people, but again, by the end of this podcast, it hopefully will not. But before we get into all of those topics, is there anything, you know, just generally in mathematical game theory that the audience should know?
Well, I think it might be helpful to know what game theory as a mathematical discipline covers.
Yes. Okay.
And sort of some of the built-in assumptions of it are that a game is going to be something where you make a choice and at least one other person makes their own choice, and then those choices end up in some sort of result. And there's three specific assumptions that we should probably think about. One is that whatever that end result is has a number attached to it. The second assumption is that everybody knows what those numbers of the different outcomes are in advance, so you know what you're playing for. And finally, that all players are rational actors who are trying to maximize whatever that end value is for themselves. And should we talk about sort of how those do or don't apply to Survivor?
Yeah, because I was going to say, as a Survivor fan, we've spoken about how that can very much not be true for Survivor. Like, as much as it is chess on an island, the island part does tend to complicate things with players acting irrationally by having other things they want in the game other than winning, as an example, which is definitely something we'll talk about. So we're going to be, I think, talking about that a lot through this podcast and really keeping up with the fact that, yeah, there's a lot more to this in Survivor, but it also works in with game theory, I think, and how people can exploit that and use that to their advantage.
Exactly. And because, you know, game theory has now been around for decades, and so it's taken into account the fact that not all situations meet those sort of very pure mathematical definitions. So we will definitely talk about how you can apply game theory, even if all of those assumptions don't hold strictly true.
So is there anything else people need to know before we jump into backwards induction?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Backwards induction. Explain this one to us. I'm handing over the reins to explain all math things to you for the entire podcast, obviously.
Oh, okay. Excellent. Ha ha ha. The power.
Yes.
So my game theory manipulation has worked. I've taken over. Okay. So for backwards induction, which seems like this very abstract phrase, I want to dive in and give you a puzzle. And I'm going to ask you just to solve it however seems natural to you. And then we'll sort of talk about how a game theoretician would solve it. But I need one data point from you, which
okay.
is, what is a beverage that's like you really enjoy drinking, that's like a treat for you, you'd be excited to drink?
Tea. Tea's like all I drink.
Tea.
Also, I regret already
excellent.
Handing over the reins and that I'm now having to solve a puzzle, unless I do really well, in which case I'm loving this.
Exactly. Remember, you have the reins of the editing, so if it goes badly, you can just pretend this never happened.
Good point. Good point. I will use that.
Yes. Okay, so here's my puzzle. So imagine that you show up to Mike Bloom's house. It's the post-coronavirus future. You get to visit him in person, and he's
nice.
So happy to see you. Yeah, he proposes a toast.
Okay.
But he puts a little game around this toast, and here's how it works.
Boy.
He's holding two trays, and on one tray is a cup of perfect tea. It's your favorite kind of tea, perfectly brewed. And next to the tea is a 10-gallon jug of Biostrath. So that's tray one, right? Perfect tea or Biostrath.
I want the Biostrath. Okay,
tea.
But for this exercise, I want the tea. I understand. Yes.
Yes. Okay, exactly. And then the second tray just has two glasses of water. And so here's how it's going to work. You make the first move. You get to choose which tray you're going to toast from. Then once you've chosen that tray, Mike assigns each of you a drink. And you have to drink whatever he assigns you, the whole thing. So you have to drink the whole water, the whole tea, or that whole 10-gallon jug of Biostrath.
Yum.
So it's your move. Which tray do you choose? And I'm happy to run that by you again if you want to hear that again.
I've got two trays, tea and
yes.
Biostrath on one, two cups of water on the other. I will choose a tray and Mike will tell me what to drink.
Exactly.
Okay.
And he'll drink the other thing, by the way.
And what will happen after? It doesn't matter. I'm just doing this one move.
Nope, the game is we're assuming you're trying to optimize your value in terms of what's a pleasant drinking experience.
Right, so I would choose the tray with the waters.
Okay, and talk me through why.
Because that's an okay chance either way, because then I'm giving Mike full control after. If I choose the other one, then he'll give me Biostrath.
Yes, exactly. So see, you solved it perfectly. You are a natural game theoretician.
when you put Biostrath in it, I will learn. That's exactly it.
Excellent. Well, see, if only they had Biostrath in the 1950s, we could have won the Cold War that much simpler.
Biostrath was always easier. The solution to the Cold War, so perfectly said.
Exactly. So, okay, so to explain why what you did was backwards induction.
Okay.
So somebody who is not very good at game theory would have just sort of said, well, one tray has something I like more, the tea. So you'd be sort of moving forward. You'd say, if I take that path, if I take a step towards that tray with the tea, then maybe I get the tea. But what you did was you jumped to the end. You said, okay, think about the world where Mike Bloom gets the tray with the Biostrath and the tea. What will his move be to end the game? And you said, okay, he's going to give you, Shannon, the Biostrath and he'll drink the tea. Or in the world where you give him the tray with the two waters, all he can do is give you the water and drink the water himself. So you started at the end, which is the backwards part, and then you sort of used logic to work backwards to your opening move. That's the induction part. You went from the specifics of his final choice to your strategy, which is backwards induction. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, but I want to say Mike Bloom is an unpleasant host. That's not how you serve a guest. but I'm glad that it worked out. So what you're basically saying is that you're thinking of where the result ends up and working backwards from there. So how is this something that can be used in Survivor?
So one of the great quotes about this is something Boston Rob said, and he was distinguishing why he did so much better in his later games than he did in his first. And he said that when he first played, he would always think about what his own best move was in any situation. But it was only when he started thinking about other people's moves that he started really controlling the game. And he didn't use the phrase backwards induction, but that's basically backwards induction. He's thinking about, okay, how can I create a situation where it's your best move to do the thing that I want you to do? And I would give you sort of the anti-Boston Rob, the opposite of that, is the Drew Christie move, where
Drew Christie is really the anti-Boston Rob. Good call on that.
Exactly. And so he wants to get rid of Kelly, right? And he says, okay, let's go down this path where I push people to vote the player I want out. And he didn't think about, okay, if we go down this path, the end result is that people are going to want to vote me out. He just saw a path that had an attractive branch somewhere down it and never thought about whether other people would choose that branch. So Drew Christie, and I'm sure if you ask Drew Christie now, he would say, yes, my mistake was I did not do sufficient backwards induction.
Mm-hmm.
What he should have done is think about, yes, exactly. It's he's known for that. So he should have thought about, okay, in what situation will the majority benefit from voting out the person I want to vote out? And then how do I choose the path where the majority is in that situation?
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring this up, because last week when we were discussing Survivor South Africa Season 5, to mention that again, but obviously it is on the brain, there was a player who wanted to make a big blindside, and he actually said the words, I haven't been in control, but now I will be. And Mike and I were like, why did he think that he would have control here? Like, there was no reason he would. He ended up getting blindsided. And I think that if he'd worked it out, he would have realized, no one else wants to do that. That's the reason you haven't had control right now. That speaks to your power in the alliance. That speaks to how much you're vibing with what everyone else wants to do. And I think he would have worked out that he was the perfect target for them and may have been able to protect against that blindside. So I think this is clearly pretty useful already for analysis, because when we're looking at people who kind of just see a shiny object of what they want, they might not be able to get it, because Survivor is all about obviously social capital and being able to make moves work within your actual framework. And sometimes you can't just make things happen and bend everyone's will to your own if that's not what they also want to do.
Yes, that is exactly right. And that is the basic principle of backwards induction. And I think, though, while we're telling people to think about the ends and work towards it, you want to be careful, because there are situations where people get in trouble with that. Sort of the classic mistake is where you choose on the first day who your goat is going to be for the final tribal council, and then you just base your whole game on dragging them to the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Sherry with Shamar and Karamoan, mm-hmm. It happens a lot. So the question is, okay, well, if we're criticizing Drew Christie for not starting at the end and working backwards, how can we criticize the person for choosing their goat on the first day? And so what I would say is there's a sort of a, and now I'm going to have to, if you want to skip forward 20 seconds, there's going to be some numbers, but mm-hmm. These will be some of the few numbers I bring in. So in a 20-player season, if I've done my math right, if you've got a final three, there are 1,140 different final three combinations you could end up with. And there's different branches that you can, there's different ways of getting there depending on the order you vote people out. So there's a total, if you look at all the different branches that the game can take, just only in terms of who you vote out when, I believe there are 400 quadrillion different paths to get there.
Wow.
You cannot hold all those paths. That's a lot of numbers. It's a four with 17 zeros.
17. There you go.
And yes, that's a lot of zeros. And there's no way you can hold that in your head in any circumstance, let alone like when you're starving and sleep deprived. So if you try to do this sort of overambitious backwards induction, you're not really doing backwards induction. I think at that point you actually are doing the shiny object thing, because you're not really doing the calculation. So mm-hmm. I would say my rule of thumb in Survivor and in life is, do backwards induction, but only try to do it as far ahead as you can keep all the different possibilities in your head. So like if you're in a tribe of 10 in Survivor and you're just trying to think one tribal council ahead, you're sort of thinking, okay, after this tribal council, when I go back to camp, having voted somebody out, what happens? That's 10 possibilities, right? Well, 9, because you're assuming you're not voted out. So you can keep those different possibilities in your head and say, okay, what's it going to be like back in camp after I vote for this person? You could even maybe do two ahead. At that point, it's like 90 different possibilities. And maybe you can do that if you're really you know, well rested and have a pencil and paper. I don't think you can do that on an island. But I think what you can start doing is, instead of thinking about it as 10 paths, I think you can start merging it into a fewer number of paths. So instead of thinking, which one person will I vote out, which might be 10 paths, you think, which of these two alliances will I side with? And that's two paths. Or, you know, will I keep my word or break it? Again, that's two paths. And that greatly reduces the number of things you're keeping in your head.
Right. Because surely if it's backwards induction, again, as a layman, I'm just going to ask, surely it's not just that you know the result. You are also working back then the steps of exactly how you are getting there. So if you just say, I'm going to the end with this person, you couldn't work back then, okay, well, that's how I'm going to get there. Through this swap, the other tribe are going to vote out these people. This is how many challenges we're going to win or lose, and then we're going to get to emerge at any given number. Like, surely there's no way you could work all the way to the end. Like, as you said, four, was it quadrillion? You know, possibilities. That would
be 400 quadrillion, huh?
Four, well, it's a lot. It's too many, is what we're trying to say. So surely you can't work backwards there, but you're saying that if you could work back, I mean, in a given round, you could work back someone's motives and the move there, surely. And then to go further than that, you would have to be saying, all right, but this person's gone. But then again, they might not be gone. And you're trying to merge those numbers closer together than say, okay, someone from this alliance will be gone, and this is something that my group can do. But that's still quite a lot the second you start getting a round or two ahead of yourself.
It absolutely is. And I think this is a case where, as useful as the game theory is, I do think you have to sort of merge it with the practical realities, which is you can sort of think about these general principles, but at a certain point, you're applying them in a sort of a general way of, okay, what's a roughly better way, rather than what are the exact 10 steps I have to take to get to this spot?
Yeah, I mean, well, the Boston Rob thing is broader than it is mathematical. I think it's just like a general sense of be thinking of what others want before you think of yourself. And then obviously factor in what you want to do within their own motivations. But I actually remember, like, to add on to the complexity that Survivor puts on it, I'm sure I have a memory of Richard Hatch berating our Rob about how Rob thought too much about people's optimal moves to make his decisions, and how he should have thought about, like, the non-optimal moves they were going to make and the subjectivity of reading people and what they will actually do. So I think that's another difficult thing when someone like Boston Rob is thinking, okay, what does Philip want to do? It's not necessarily the optimal thing, and he has to work with reading Philip as a person to work out what he's going to do to then work his move in within that.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. And I mean, is this a good place maybe to talk about the idea of utility?
Yes, I think that's very important. Let's do that.
Okay, so I mentioned that one of the assumptions of game theory is that everything has a mathematical value and people rationally pursue that. And if you look at it one way, Survivor does have a very clear mathematical value. There's $1 million for the winner. There's $100,000 for second place, and so forth. But if you look at people's behavior, people sometimes seem to be acting very irrationally if their goal is to optimize the dollar value of money they take home. So I think that there's what's helpful to think about. So one of the tools that people use when they try to apply the mathematical precision of something like game theory to the messiness of real life is this concept of utility. Mm-hmm. The idea is that money is valuable to me, but I also get utility. I get value out of being honest or having people like me or having an adventure. And sometimes people will make up a unit of that. They'll say, how many utils is that worth for you? And nobody thinks you can really put a number value on how many utils is having children worth to me? How many utils is a pet? But it can be a way of sort of expressing relative value. So I think in Survivor, you have to think about what people are getting utility out of that is beyond that final dollar value.
Yeah, this is something we're going to talk about a lot in this podcast, and something that I find really fascinating that I didn't know about a week ago, but that I now found really fascinating, because Survivor should be more robotic than it is. Obviously, also, people are bad players. I think that's the thing, like, people will just make bad moves. But beyond that, if everyone was just playing to win and for the $1 million totally optimally, then you could just go through the Boston Rob strategy, assuming people are going to play well, and work through it in that way. But you have to also look at why people are there, and it's something we'll talk about in some of the other concepts, because it's something that can be exploited, it's something that can be used, and it's something that definitely should be read, which is, this person might make a move so that they can be the honest guy. That's a utility to them. That's important to them. That's however many utils to be that person. So it's something we've talked about as well in the psychological podcast, which makes sense because it's so factored into people's identity and how much they care about these things. But it's definitely something you need to be reading out on the island because it's not just $1 million that people are often playing for.
Absolutely. And the game theory analogy is there's certain games where you and I get different point totals for different things. So if you imagine we're playing, it's a game sort of like Risk, but I get more points for geographically bigger countries and you get more points for more populous countries. There's going to be certain cases where we're both competing over the same country, but there's going to be certain cases where I can kind of let you take a country that's less valuable to me. And there's no assumption that you will necessarily tell me and be honest about what you're getting points for. But a game theory principle is that your moves, if you are pursuing your interest, I can deduce from your moves what you get points from. Mm-hmm. So I think similarly on Survivor, if you are acting in a way, if you're making moves that make you seem more honest, but make it harder for you to get to the $1 million, then I know you're getting utility out of that honesty. And when I'm figuring out my optimal move, I can start factoring in that knowledge into my decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one that we could really easily point to, but it's so consistent with Survivor, like, the whole time. But Tony and Wu, for example, like, Tony knows that Wu cares about being the honorable one. He uses that to his advantage. The optimal move in terms of Wu being honorable is to take Tony to the end. In that utility, that is how he's going to get the most utils of honorability. I'm just saying words at this point. But to us as Survivor fans and analyzers, that seems nonsensical because that's not what the game is. And also, we don't even think that honor should matter. So, and we also don't think it even makes him more honorable. There was a lot of things wrong with the move, but in his mind, that's something that he gets points for in that way. And someone like Tony, I think Wu was pretty obvious about being the honorable guy, but if he wasn't so explicit about it, he could be reading, okay, in the way that you vote, maybe you're someone who, like Coach, for example, doesn't vote for Boston Rob. Votes for Courtney, but still Boston Rob goes home. Okay, that's a move I can read that shows that this is something that you care about that I can use to my advantage later. Russell does, you know, uses so much, always catering to Coach's honor. Again, it wasn't subtle, but it's something you can read in that way.
Yeah, so first of all, just to jump back to something you said a moment ago, if I'm ever on Survivor and I form a band in Ponderosa, I'm calling it the Utils of Honor. That's a great name, great band name. But, yeah. But I think maybe
if you're just jumping into the zero-sum game, we're talking a whole different language at this point.
Yeah. Should we talk about zero-sum games? Like that's very closely related to this idea of different utilities.
I do. I just had one more question about backwards induction before we do. Is that for me? Here's how I'm seeing it. Again, as a newbie to all of this, is you can if you're looking at it and trying to work out results and trying to work out your move from there and trying to work out everyone else's motivation. I think you can try and make your move on that, but as we've said, it might be difficult to look too far ahead. I see it in two ways. I see it, can you use it collaboratively and defensively? Like in terms of collaboration to work out everyone's best move, what their result is going to be, and try and make that work with you. It's something we talked about in the Plurality Vote podcast of this like third faction coming together to do what is of benefit to all of you. If someone like Aubrey and Sydney thinking, okay, Michelle and Julia, their end result is that they're going to work so that Scott and Jason are still in the game so they can still play the middle. We're going to work so that the idol doesn't, you know, the idol bomb doesn't go off. We can do that together. That's how I see it in collaboration. Defensively, I would say if you can understand everyone else's motivation and their end goal, surely you can see like the bullet coming before it does and protect it. Is that enough of backwards induction or is that just playing the game well?
No, those are both absolute backwards induction examples. Those are absolute examples of backwards induction. And I think those are great ways of bringing that into Survivor.
So if we have one last hypothesis before we get to zero sum games, do you, as the math genius, have a place where you think people should stop? It's too far now to look ahead. Would you give like a sweet spot of how far people should be using this and seeing that end result and working backwards from it?
So again, not a genius, but I would say for me, I would say it's in terms of specific people of who you're going to vote for. I would say it's one move ahead at the beginning of the game when there's 10 people, maybe two moves ahead when you're starting to get down to six people, five people, and beyond. If you're thinking beyond that, if the branches are getting too big for you to keep in your head, I think you just have to start thinking in terms of like two splits at each decision. In other words, do I go with this alliance or that alliance? Mm-hmm. Do I go for a strength or for a weakness? Do I go for keeping the tribe strong or eliminating competitors? If you're just thinking about two paths at each junction, I think you can then start thinking, I don't know, five or six moves ahead. But again, it has to be, it's whatever number you can keep in your head where you could really think about the final outcome of each of those paths. Then you can really do that backwards induction. I think other than that, if you can't think that far ahead, you need to be using other techniques, whether they're from game theory or psychology or what have you.
Yeah, it does seem like much later in the game is when you can start looking slightly further ahead. Because like in the pre-merge, you don't even know who's going to win immunity next time. You don't know who the other tribe are voting out, how that will affect you. If, you know, if they vote out someone strong, then you don't need your strength as much. Like it all is this domino effect. And then by the time you get to the merge, there's still quite a few people there, but you have more of a handle on it. But then as you're saying, like that 5-6 area, that might be the time. And that's one vote at this point, pretty much, because the final four. So for the final five, look ahead. Final six, baby. We got you covered.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Zero-sum game. Explain it to the people.
Okay, so there's different kinds of games, and often when people think about competition and strategy, they intuitively think about a zero-sum game. And what that is so poker, for example, Shannon, if you and I show up to the poker table with $100 in each of our pockets, then if I leave with $120, we know mathematically you are leaving with 80. So the amount that I gain from that, I gain $20. Therefore, you must gain negative $20, right? The amount that I win plus the amount that you win adds to zero. Mm-hmm. The sum of those two is zero. It's a zero sum game. Technically, in terms of money, Survivor is what's called a fixed sum game. Like, it's not like I show up with $1 million and I lose it. There's $1 million on the table for us to share, so it's this fixed sum. Mm-hmm. But in casual conversation, people would call that a zero sum game, because whatever I take out of that $1 million is you lose, or whatever odds I increase of getting that $1 million are odds that go down for you to get it. And so in a zero sum game, and I'm going to use zero sum casually to mean constant sum, as it's generally used.
Actually, I'll give you another example. The one in the audience is thanking you, and that person's probably my brother. I'll just tell him to just
exactly.
Let it go.
Every time I insist that I'm not a math genius or an expert, your brother, I'm picturing your brother just like shaking his head, disking whatever I'm saying. So, yes.
That actually does pretty much track with, nah, he'll be fine. Get over it. All right.
Okay, good. Cute. Another great example of a zero-sum game is the greatest game on earth, the Chizzy Points, right?
Okay, I love this.
If I get, you know, you have six Chizzy points to give out, right? 3, 2, 1.
Mm-hmm,
and anybody, if somebody gets 3 Chizzy points, that's 3 Chizzy points that aren't available for somebody else. Mm-hmm. So it's a zero-sum game. But the challenge for the player of a zero-sum game is there's not really much room for negotiation or compromise, right? Like if we're playing poker, I say, well, look, Shannon, if you just lose $20 on this round, then like, what am I offering you? Then I'm like, well, then you'll have $20 less. But there's also what's called a constant sum game. I'll give you a simple example. It's like a labor negotiation, where if I work for you and you're trying to work out like a fair price to pay me, we both benefit if you can find a fair price and your business can stay in operation. If you can't pay me fairly and I go on strike and we both starve, we both have lost. Whereas if you pay me fairly and we both profit, then we're both making more. The sum total of the value we get out of it is greater than it would be in a different situation. That's called the variable sum game, and it just means that there's different amounts of money, and we can work together to maximize that amount for both of us.
While we're here 30 minutes into this math podcast, like this, I honestly been thinking, like, I don't know if the Chizzy should be a zero-sum game. It is now, but it doesn't really make sense, does it? Like, the Chizzy would make more sense, I feel like, if it was like, wow, that was an amazing move, 10 points to you. Whereas, like, no one was really good this week, and no one's getting points. Like, I feel like that would be better. People get, like, locked into these, I've been thinking about it. They get locked into the votes. Sometimes it doesn't work out. Other than that, the Chizzy is perfect, but maybe it should be completely different. I love that you use it as an example.
So, I mean, the consequence, though, the difference between a zero-sum and a non-zero-sum is that people can cooperate. So you run the risk. I'm sure that people go on International Survivor primarily to get the Chizzy points. So you could be breaking South African Survivor, Australian Survivor, because people will start collaborating. They're like, I don't care if I lose this game. I just want the Chizzy points. We can benefit. And so, you know, do you dare ruin Survivor just to tweak the Chizzy points?
I know you're making fun, but you honestly don't know how right you are. It has happened before. People care more about it. But I think what you're trying to say is that we talk about the concept of utility. So Survivor, I'm thinking, should be a zero-sum game. There's a certain amount of money. Everyone's got a placement, a value of that. And only one person can win. Only one person can come in each slot there. But it often isn't a zero-sum game because there's often more to be gained for people. I think a really good example might be like Colby taking Tina to the end. That should be a zero-sum game. Colby should not take Tina because then he lost and she won. Only one winner. If he didn't take her to the end, he would have won. She would have lost. That was the other option. But at the time, there was more to be gained by the biggest show in the world that was getting 50 million viewers every week, where he came out as like the hero and he got endorsements and he didn't sully his good name. And then he gained from that. He gained honor utils, which is a thing. He gained probably money from it. He gained, I think he was probably fan favorite. All the things that he gained by being this hero had actual value. It wasn't even that it was fake. Like, we think that Wu's thing is fake, that honor thing didn't matter to him at all. He should have just won the game. But for Colby, I think there was actually more there to be gained, and he did gain it, even though he lost the technical game of Survivor.
Absolutely. And I often think, in terms of Survivor and utility and that zero-sum question, I think about something that Johnny Fairplay said, which I think is one of the greatest insights I've ever heard into Survivor, which is he said that he, at the start of the game, realized that only one person could walk away with that $1 million, but everybody could get famous. Mm-hmm. And that a
boring game, I don't know, in 2003, but maybe.
Yeah. Well, it worked for him in any case. But so the idea is that if you work together with the other players to make it a exciting, interesting game, you increase the amount of fame and attention that is available to you. So, you know, this is the idea that Survivor does not have to be a zero-sum game. I think of as the Johnny Fairplay principle. And so, you know, the great minds of game theory, it's like John Van Neumann, John Nash, Johnny Fairplay. It's like all the great Johns have contributed to the field.
No one tell Johnny Fairplay that we said that, guys. It's not worth it to call him a great mathematical mind. But this is what I'm saying about the Chizzy. So if the Chizzy was a variable sum game, sorry to always bring back to the Chizzy, but you did start it. Then two players would come to each other and say, hey, let's make like the biggest move of the game. We'll both get 50 points. We'll both win the Chizzy, which is what we care about. But that can't happen now because it's all locked into the zero-sum game. You can't help someone make the best move ever and get 2 points because they're going to get 3, and that locks you out of the 3.
It's true.
Is the Chizzy math correct?
So the Chizzy math is correct. This actually brings us, though, to the question of correlated equilibrium, because it occurs to me there is a way that people can work together to maximize their Chizzy points.
Okay. Talking about Survivor as a variable sum game, we have some of these examples. Let's talk through it. How can people actively get more out of Survivor and have those other utilities that make Survivor a variable sum game? Or how can it be exploited in some of these other ways we talk about, like with Tony?
Okay, so I would say the general way I would think about it is as a question of magnification. That if you look at Survivor just on that one level, as it's one game and there's $1 million prize at the end, that is a zero sum game. Mm-hmm. But if you zoom back and you say there's things you get outside of the game, this honor, this fame, then you're expanding the prize pool at that point. You're opening room for negotiation. And with some people, you can negotiate explicitly, like Tony did with Wu. You're saying, do this move, you will gain honor utils. And you didn't use the word utils, but it really was an explicit negotiation about this extra thing Wu could get outside of the game. Sometimes you might use it implicitly, where if somebody is not aware of their own interests and motivations, you can say, you know, don't you want to take charge of this game? If you're dealing with an Andrew Savage who thinks he's playing to win, but really is getting a lot of utility out of being in control and being the guy everyone looks up to, you pretend you're maximizing his odds of winning, but you're really maximizing his odds of control. So, you know, you say, take this move, you will take control of the game. And that, you know, and then that way we're both more likely to end up at the end. And for you, the ending up at the end might be the maximum thing you're getting value of. But for Savage, I think, subconsciously or not, that taking control of the game is adding on value to the game to him that opens up room for negotiation.
Yeah, I think there's a difference when people like actively are seeking out that thing and it's really valid as a utility versus having it incorporated into what they hope to be a winning game. Like something like Savage, as you said, he thinks it's a winning game. You're relying on his misunderstanding of the game, but it is within him wanting to win. But then you look at some other examples, like we do with Colby, for example, where there is legitimate utility beyond the game, where there can be like total collaboration in Survivor, which there shouldn't be because you can't split the prize money. But definitely an example that comes to mind again would be like Rob and Amber. Like they, I don't know if they knew at the time how much they were going to be like a married couple, but there was extreme utility in them collaborating, which should not be a thing that exists in Survivor so perfectly. Like if you're a partnership, you both can't win. And that's why while it's helpful to have a partner, at some point you have to come for each other. Like there is a downside to that. Whereas like they got married, they got $1 million and a car, I think two cars, and then obviously became Rob and Amber. And there was like extreme utility to that, like kind of broke the game because the game of Survivor itself, other than the utility that you get from it, it should be that zero-sum game. I'm saying game a lot. It should be that thing where only one person can win, so you have to slit your ally's throat at a point, but they work their way around it by getting married.
Yeah, although you know, you say it should be a zero-sum game, but I think a lot of the sort of the fun and interest of Survivor comes from that tension that ultimately, financially, in terms of prize money, it is zero-sum, but in terms of all the things around it, the adventure, the fame, it's not zero sum. And I'd actually say, by the way, that's sort of talking about ways you can zoom out and see the big picture. I think if you zoom in and see Survivor not as one 39-day game, but as a series of individual games, so like each vote out is an individual game, I think to some degree those become non-zero sum games because I can work with you in any given vote out to increase our chance of advancing, to increase our chance of getting to the end. And so there is something there that we can both benefit from. So there is that room for negotiation for any given round of the game.
Yeah, I definitely think each round would be a variable sum game because you can all get, I think, I mean, when it's bad to say this on the Match podcast, but like unquantifiable benefits and losses out of a single round of Survivor. Like you can definitely work together and collaborate and not be actively taking for each other in a single round of the show.
Exactly. And I'll say, just to give you like a specific example, if, you know, if there's five of us in a tribe and we're going to vote out and person number five is going to go home, you can think about two paths. One is which all four of us are united and vote for that fifth person. And then that person loses, but then we all move forward united. Or, you know, three of us vote for that person. One of those people votes against another, that person, and you've got this mess. So then the same person goes home. So they get the same zero utility. But the rest of us get less utility because we're moving forward with less unity and therefore less odds of ultimately making it to the end.
Yeah, I think that there's benefit, mutual benefit in these variable sum games of every round of Survivor. The one I would say that there isn't is the final tribal council, a final two or final three. Like, I think that to me looks like the single round that is a zero sum game. There's only one winner, one second place, sometimes a third place. So I think that that's something that you can really look at if you're in the game and analyze. If someone wants to go to a final three with you in a zero-sum game, I think you have to ask yourself why. Like, are they delusional? Are you delusional? Do they have another utility that matters to them, or they think that you do? Do they not actually want to take you, so they're going to blindside you, so that's something that could signal to you, like, why would they sit next to you in a game where only one of you can win, and there is no mutual benefit in that round? And I think that working that out can be key to figuring out if you're going to get blindsided or if you're wrong in your reading of the jury? Are you going with someone who can beat you?
So yeah, so what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And it goes back to that question of judging people's values within the game, judging people's method of scoring the game by not just what they say, but by what they do. And you've put your finger on something that if people are saying their values are one thing, they're saying, I want to win the game, and that's why I'm taking you, but you can see that their move decreases their odds of winning, then you know there's something else going on. And maybe it means that they have values you don't know, or maybe it means they're lying about what they actually intend to do.
Maybe it means you're a goat and you don't know. And now you have to think about, maybe they can beat you at the end, and that's why they want to go with you, and maybe you shouldn't be going to the end with them.
Absolutely. But, you know, I will say that there is this brings up another kind of emergent strategy in the game, which is if you get to the point where you know you are going to lose, you can really start thinking about, okay, what other utility can I get out of the game? And actually, I would say this is Troizan, right, in that final tribal council, where he says, look, I can read the room. I know I'm not going to win. And he just sort of decides at that point his utility is going to come out of except enjoying the moment and being a good sport about the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, hard for me to buy that one when he immediately blocked me on Twitter for no reason. But sure, we'll go with Troizan. I mean, I was thinking of Ben, which is obviously the most recent one. And that's why when you look at these other utilities, it's something that I think we as super fans really can undermine. I mean, we talk about the Wu thing. As I've said, I don't think that's legit. And it's something any super fan will say, like, you idiot, like, you're not working optimally to win the game. And I've definitely been guilty of that at times. And I think we as super fans fall into that trap of only seeing winning and the game. Obviously, we spend our lives like talking about the game. We see that as the thing. Like, if you're not working optimally just for the game itself, for that $1 million, like, you're doing the wrong thing. But when Ben actively quit or you know, laid down his sword there at the final five, I really loved that move at the time because I said, okay, he knows he can't win. He doesn't want to sit at a final three and get berated. This is actually something that recently happened on Survivor South Africa Champions as well. It's been a very relevant season to talk about. It's something that happened on Survivor New Zealand Thailand at the final four. People didn't want to go sit at the end and get berated when they had the self-awareness to know that they weren't going to win and they weren't going to get those votes. And even in something like US Survivor, where you get more actual money the further that you get in the game and there's extreme value in that, the utility for Ben was like seasons in the making, where he had seen himself as the winner who couldn't make friends and he was so individual and he needed this advantage. And for him, like, his relationships were more important, and validating to himself that he's someone who can have lifelong relationships from the show and how important they are was more important to him than winning Survivor again. I think with Winners at War, there was a lot of these extra utilities because everyone had already won the game, so they all brought like extra baggage of the other thing they wanted that was important to them, to prove to themselves or to prove to others that they could do.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that insight that Winners at War is an especially good season to look for these extra game utilities, that's a great point. Anyway, I think it comes back to, in terms of sort of the rationality of that, should we criticize people for this? Should we accept it? To me, it comes back to the fair play principle, which is only
don't
one
don't call
person.
It the fair play principle. No one tell fair play that we created the fair play principle on this podcast.
So it comes back to that work of genius by the greatest minds of the past 1,000 years, Johnny Fairplay, that only one person gets the $1 million. That's, you've got a 1 in 20 odds of getting the $1 million. But if you're looking for a different kind of utility, you can maybe bring your odds up to 100% of having an adventure. You can bring your odds up to, I don't know, 30% of getting famous. It's a rational thing to improve your odds of getting something you want. And maybe because in the home audience, we are told the value of that $1 million prize, and it's roughly the same value for all of us. So I think we really understand the utility of that on an instinctive level. But, you know, maybe for Wu, the utility of making that one decision really was worth more than $1 million to you or me. It may have been a rational decision. And I think we can criticize it as a strategic decision if we define strategy as optimizing your odds of winning the game. But maybe what we're discovering is you can be rational even when you're not being strategic.
Yeah, I think with Wu, you can look at it as, okay, how much did he do it because he thought he could actively beat Tony? Because that's just wrong. Versus, like, how much was he really doing it to be honorable? How much was he being manipulated into it versus, like, knowing what he was doing and caring about it? And also then in that, did it make him more honorable? Is that something he actually achieved in that? So there's a few layers to that. But I think, like, if everyone came out seeing him as more honorable and that was important to him, like, you can't knock that that was something he was gaining for himself if that was important to him.
Yes, and even if he came out seeing himself as more honorable, because your own people get utility out of their own self-image. And that's, you know, that's something you talked with about with Dr. Amanda Rabinowitz, that there is, it's not just a psychological trick. If you really can do something in the game that makes somebody feel better about themselves, arguably you are helping them, you are giving them utility.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about Winners at War is that because they were all winners, they all won $1 million, $2 million for Sandra. But what they'd also want is the additional utilities of being a survivor winner, which I think go missing when it's like you win $1 million. They also want like being able to say, I'm a survivor winner, being able to know to themselves that that's something that they could do and achieve. And I think that's maybe why we saw so many other utilities coming out. Not that $2 extra million wouldn't matter to pretty much all of these people. I'm pretty sure Yule is like one of the richest people ever. Maybe not to Yule, but to most of them, $2 million is going to make a difference. And I think we saw parts of that. But I think once you took out, okay, winning doesn't mean you get the extra utility of being a survivor winner because you already are. It doesn't mean that extra self-assurance necessarily because you already did it. Then we made room for other utilities that everyone had within their baggage. For Sophie, it was like, I want to show that I can be a leader type because everyone called me a follower. Someone like Michelle wanted to show really active gameplay because people thought she was passive. Like, there was a lot people were trying to prove because they'd freed up that room by already winning.
Yeah, absolutely. And thinking about what you're saying, there's a concept that maybe we're getting now more into economics and game theory, but it's marginal utility, which is not just what is the value of a dollar, but what is the value of the next dollar. So if I'm starving, the marginal utility of $1, the value of that extra dollar above zero is huge. If I'm Yule, the value of that extra dollar is probably negligible. So, and I think marginal utility comes in for psychological utility as well, that if you've already proven to yourself that you can win Survivor once, the marginal utility of winning it again is less. And so you can start looking at other things that you are poorer in, that you are poorer in your belief in your leadership, you're poorer in your belief in your strategic game, whatever that is, the marginal utility is greater. And I think maybe where that comes in terms of something that's useful when you're playing the game is you look around when you're judging what other people's utility are. You can also look at the utility they've already gotten out of the game. And sort of ask yourself, what does this person feel poor in? How is this person's utility changing over the course of the game? And therefore, how do I have to change my strategy? How do I have to change my backwards induction, my beliefs about what decisions they'll make when I put them in a certain situation?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Like, if you think someone's like a big game player, they're looking to make a big move. If they've already made that big move, then that might not be as attractive an option to them. So it's something that's evolving with them. The utilities obviously aren't completely static.
Exactly. Or, you know, Will Wall in Millennials vs. Gen X, it seemed like he got to a point where he just could not wait any longer to make a big move, where it's like the every round he did not make a big move, the utility to him, the marginal utility of the next big move got bigger and bigger till he finally had to make it.
Yeah, I think the utility thing is really interesting, and it definitely does. It goes into the podcast that we did with Dr. Amanda Rabinowitz in terms of the psychological principles, because we talked then about basically people's arbitrary belief systems and how ascribing to them can feel vital and bigger than the game. And at the time I was like, and I still stand by it, it's like, it's not bigger than the game. You think that you are the heroes, that your group's the most important group that's ever happened, that you have to stick loyal to that because it says something so important about you. And that's not true. But as we're saying, if it's true to them, there's utility in that. That is going to dictate how they make their moves. And if you're really smart, you can exploit that and say like, hey, with this group of people, we are so it's so important that we stick to that. And you give them that option, and then they work to your benefit, and you're the one winning the game, which is, you know, the actual game of Survivor that you are looking to win.
Absolutely. And I think tying some of the idea of marginal utility into that idea that you're wrong about what you think you want. I think when you're out on the island and you're separated from support and from love and trust, the marginal value of those things becomes suddenly much higher. And so it becomes very hard to judge what the value of those outside the game is. And so I think when you have the chance to be part of a group in Survivor, it seems, you know, in real life, you would not give up $1 million to hang out with a bunch of cool people. But in Survivor, But in Survivor, the marginal utility of that extra bit of social interaction, of belonging, of trust is suddenly huge because you've suddenly become extremely deprived of those things.
The fact that Survivor is mathematical game theory plus psychology is literally why I love it so much. That is the one line summation of that. But just to like bring it back to Graham's tweet, which was the tweet obviously that made me think, I don't know what a zero-sum game is. It's something I need to learn because it's something the players are thinking about. He basically said that because Survivor is a zero-sum game, everyone was making moves. You know, and if you're not going to make moves in a zero-sum game, then you become a puppet who has just assigned yourself to losing the game. So his assumption was that they would be making the optimal moves for themselves and that they would flip on him to win, which would be the correct move. And that caused him to flip on his allies instead. So in rereading that tweet and understanding it and doing the research into it, I think there's all these other factors there that came to mind for me. Like, I think there was the irrationality. I think there was non-optimal play. There's these other utilities. Like, he was playing with some very loyal people. In a zero-sum game, yes, they are flipping on him 10 out of 10 times. It's the optimal move. It's the thing to do. If you're looking to just win Survivor straight out and win R1 million, like, that's the thing to do. But he gives them more credit than me. I don't know if they ever would have done it, because the utility of being loyal to the group, and also maybe the lack of awareness, the irrationality of thinking that maybe they could win in a different pathway of sitting next to a big threat, I think that factors into it, and that's what makes Survivor not as simple as a zero-sum game as we might have thought.
Absolutely. And I think that just as people get in trouble by the Drew Christie thing of not really thinking about other people's rational interests, I do think you can get in trouble by thinking too much, by assuming too much, not just too much rationality, but by assuming the same set of values. And it, you know, it comes back to that idea of a game where you get rewarded for conquering countries with lots of people, and I get rewarded for conquering ones with lots of land. That if I don't know that we're being scored on different measures, what seems like a rational move to me is a mistake. And it sounds to me like he was assuming that everybody else was playing the same way he was. And that is clearly a mistake.
To be fair, like, he did a lot of great stuff anyway. And he was already, you know, he was overly cautious possibly, but he made it work. He was an excellent player. And I think it does show that he was looking at it on this, like, extreme game theory level. I still think maybe he was overestimating his competition against himself. And that's something we talk about, as we said, that Richard Hatch said to Rob, you're looking at everyone's optimal move. Maybe everyone else isn't as smart as you. Maybe you're thinking, if you were them, if I, Rob, was Christy Smith, I'm doing this thing, right? But she's Christy Smith, she's going to do something else. So it's kind of looking at that. And I guess you would never say underestimate your opponents, but maybe you're overestimating them. Maybe that's okay because you get the jump on them anyway, which is what Graham did. And I don't know, hard to fault it very much, but I'm glad I finally understand that tweet. Should we move on to the next concept?
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Okay, you can explain it again. Reign's over, please don't give me more puzzles. I don't know if I'll get the next one right, but Nash Equilibrium is the next concept that we are talking about.
And actually, this is a perfect segue from that, because it is this concept of should I flip, should I change my strategy based on what other people are doing?
I wish that we had talked about it before we did the entire flip podcast, but it's fine. We'll talk about it now.
Okay, excellent. Okay, so if you go back to that game that we talked about with Mike Bloom, where you've got the two trays.
Mike, please, I just want to have a cup of tea. Came all the way from Australia for this? No.
Look, don't blame, it's Mike Bloom's fault, Joff. Take up with him when we're done with his podcast.
Yeah.
So here's my question. So what you, and this is gonna be another puzzle, but I promise you it's one that I think you know the answer to. It's a simple one. The conclusion you came to is that you would pick the tray with the two waters. So my question is, could you do better if you, given what you know, that Mike is always going to choose the thing he likes, that he finds tastiest, could you do better by changing your strategy in that game?
No.
Correct. And the other thing is, given that that's your strategy, you're going to pick the tray with the two waters, is there anything Mike Bloom can do to come up with a better option at the end for him?
He could change the trays, change what's on the trays, put bias.
Oh, good point. Okay,
water.
So I'm assuming that the game is fixed, assuming that the trays are locked in place.
Because I got you, Mike. Never forget. All right, but no. Yeah. Okay. So in what way are you trying to get him to change his options?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll just tell you that you're probably confused because it's such an obvious thing. He's choosing between two glasses of water at that point.
Right.
It's like there's nothing.
Okay.
So all I'm saying is that in that point, you've made, given your strategy, there's nothing he can do different. And given his strategy, there's nothing you can do different. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of an equilibrium to that. The game is sort of fixed. That's assuming you're both rational. You will always end up picking that tray with the two waters because that's your best move. He will always end up just picking either one because his best move is the same in that case. And so that state is called Nash equilibrium, named after John Nash, who's one of the first game theory pioneers. We've gotten this deep into a game theory podcast, and we haven't explained, if you've seen the movie A Beautiful Mind, that's about John Nash, who's this game theory pioneer. And it's a very Hollywoodized, fictionalized version, but it maybe will give you sort of a fun introduction to it.
I saw that a very long time ago, not to the point where I can remember it.
So you don't remember the whole scene where John Nash is discussing Biostrath and tea?
Yeah, I also wanted to say that we don't endorse on this podcast that choosing Biostrath is an inherently irrational choice. That's why I think that the whole thing, because I might have thought Mike wanted the Biostrath and then he would choose that, I would get the tea. But anyway, it's fine. We endorse Biostrath.
Okay, fair. For sure. That's a fair point. Yes, I don't mean to slander Biostrath. But so we have this thing called Nash equilibrium. And that's basically a state where, given your strategy, the other player can't do better by changing theirs. And given their strategy, you can't do better by changing yours. So it's like a sum total of strategies. Does that make sense? Should I give another example?
Give another example. Sure, I can't hurt. I get it.
Okay.
For the listeners. Give another one.
Yes, okay. So assume that we're playing chicken. And it's a traditional game of chicken where you're driving a car straight at me, I'm driving a car straight at you. And first of all, it's a non-zero-sum game in that, like, if I swerve and if we both swerve, we're maybe both a little embarrassed. But if we both go straight, we both die. So clearly there's like different game states. Yes, exactly. So there's a variable sum. We can get different amounts of utility depending on the outcome. So assuming that you've decided you're going to be driving straight towards me. And then suddenly you have a flash of psychic powers and you realize that I'm going to be driving straight towards you. So can you now do better by changing your strategy?
Yes, I cannot drive to my death. Is this still a puzzle? Exactly. I know how to stay alive. Yes.
Exactly. Well done. So yes. So and similarly, if I'm going to, supposing I, instead, you're planning on swerving and you know you get the psychic flash that tells you I'm going to swerve. Now, can you do better by changing your strategy?
I would then change to drive straight.
Exactly. So those situations where you've got a strategy, and once you know my strategy, you know you can do better, that is not equilibrium, because things are going to change. Whereas if, given my strategy, you're doing the best thing you can, and given your strategy, I'm doing the best thing I can, we will both go ahead with that strategy. We can't do better. There's this sort of optimal solution for each of us to increase our chances. That's called Nash equilibrium. And it's sort of a fancy way of saying it, but basically, if people are being rational, that's where games tend to end up. That in the Mike Bloom toasting thing, the game is going to end up with both of you drinking water because that's Nash equilibrium. In chicken, if we can read each other's minds, we'll then one of us will always end up swerving. Exactly.
If you can predict that Mike Bloom doesn't want Biostrath, then that's how you...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And here's a question of utils, because who would not want the vitalizing powers of Biostrath? So clearly he's being irrational in that case, but yes, exactly.
But you're reading him, and that's what Survivor is, mostly reading people. So how can this be, you know, used in analyzing Survivor?
Okay, so it's useful in a couple of ways. First of all, if you're just trying to predict where the game is going to go, things tend to end up in a state of Nash equilibrium. Basically, you figure out the strategy. And this is a sense, this is tied into backwards induction, because you're figuring out other people's best moves and assuming they're rational, or at least assuming you know what utility they've got that makes them behave in seemingly irrational ways, you can then figure out what they're going to do. I'm going to use Nash equilibrium here in a slightly casual and sloppy way, because technically Nash equilibrium is about a set of strategies within a moment, right? It's like at that moment before we both start driving off, we both have strategies that we're going to implement, and those strategies are in equilibrium. But I think in a broader sense, you can think about equilibrium in terms of the game, where we're going to keep using the same strategies, and those strategies are going to be in equilibrium again and again. So if we have a situation where I am in a dominant four-person alliance, and you are in the weaker three-person alliance, it will always be in the advantage of the four people in my alliance to vote against your three. That is the equilibrium state. And given that, there's nothing that you three can do to do any better. You can vote for whoever you want. One of you is still going to get voted out. So that is an equilibrium state, and it's very frustrating for you. So how can you improve that? How can you stop the game from getting fixed in that way? So one of the things that the really great players do is they create a feeling of false Nash equilibrium. They create the illusion of Nash equilibrium. So Boston Rob is a master at making all seven people in that situation think they're in his alliance. So everybody in the game thinks their best move is to stick with Rob. If in a perfect world where they had psychic powers, they might know that it's not really Nash equilibrium, that they can do better. But he's created this false sense of your best move is to stick with a plan, stick with me. And so in vote after vote, he's able to control it because people think their best move is to go with him. A different player who creates this sense of false equilibrium in a very different way is Sandra. And she can't do this anymore. But in her first two games, she was really able to convince people that their best move was to take her to the end and beat her. And eventually people figured out you can't take Sandra to the end and beat her. But for those first two games, she created this belief that somebody's best move was to take her along. And once you've done that, it creates a sort of a stability in the game where there, you can predict things because everybody's best move is to stick with the strategy they have.
You say that Nash equilibrium is a moment, and I think I saw that moment, like the exact second where it happened, in Sandra's second game when she's trying to fight against Russell, vote Russell out, like she's changing her move. She's not just staying with the status quo. And then Russell says to her that he can beat her, and she says, I don't know about that, but she's happy to stick with that. And once she's happy to divert to the status quo, obviously the villains are too. They're in control. They're getting to the end. And once she gets on board with that and knows that she can go to the end with them and that she'll probably beat them, I think they're all in that moment that of Nash equilibrium where it's like, all right, well, we're just going to stay doing this. And it's a false, you know, optimal thing for Russell and for many of the villains who think they'll win, but it's right for her. And she's created that and just fed into it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so if you're in a situation where there's a state of equilibrium in the game where nobody seems to benefit from changing their strategy, one thing to remember, one way this can be useful as a practical game tool, is that Nash equilibrium defines itself in terms of single player strategies, right? I can't improve my game given that you're keeping your strategy the same. So like in the chicken game, my knowledge that I should swerve depends on the assumption that you aren't changing your strategy, that you are going to drive ahead. Mm-hmm. So I think that one of the keys to this is in Survivor is that if you can move as a twosome, if you can team up with somebody and convince each other that your interests are the same, at least for this round, now it's not just you changing your move, it's somebody else. And I think this is sort of like a game theory explanation of why you have twosomes, like Rob and Mateo in the Amazon, or Tony and Trish, and then Tony and Wu in Cagayan, where if you can flip with somebody else, you are essentially acting like one player with two votes. And that changes the calculation because suddenly you can change who goes home just by changing your move, you being the duo. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you give more power to that. If everyone else is in this like static state and you are the ones changing it, if you can actually have power there to affect that change, that's what has power in that situation.
Yes. Yes. I would say that's basically right. That if you can, that if you can get somebody else to change their vote at the same time you do, then you can shake up that Nash equilibrium state.
So Wittepagonging, that would be like classic Nash equilibrium.
Exactly, because each round after round, it's in one group of people's interests to keep their votes the same. That's exactly right.
In old school Survivor, I feel like that was true. Like that wasn't a false sense of it. I think that was true a lot of the time, especially when like there weren't idols and you were getting down to an alliance of several people and individual immunities mattered more and you were giving yourself a fighting chance and there was nothing the minority could do other than just, you know, make the best of it, try and get as far as they could. I think we're trying to explain now that Nash equilibrium is what's happening in the Survivor production department where they're saying, hey, we can't let games tend towards this anymore. We have to shake it up and shake it up every round. And they have done that by creating this big moves mentality and all the advantages and things. But I think that what they were fighting against was exactly this.
Absolutely. And I think, speaking of, you can see moments where something happens. I think the moment where the ability of a tribe to maintain Nash equilibrium for Pagonging shifted was the moment where Yol says, I have the god idol, and you, Penner, will get voted out if you don't change your vote. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, it suddenly Penner's strategy is no longer stable. It is no longer in his interest to make the same decision again. It is in his interest, assuming that everybody else holds steady, it is in his interest to flip. So that is, you know, one of the great insights, I think, of Survivor production and then of Yule, is that you can shake up a situation by changing people's incentives with an idol. So you're absolutely right. It does make the game a lot less stable.
Yeah, and that made sense. Like, when pogroms were happening, that made a lot of sense. The problem was then they kept adding to it. But now, I'm happy with Nash Equilibrium for a couple of episodes. Let's just keep it chill. But they want, like, 3 flips an episode. So we can't even stay static for 1 second. People can't stay with just their optimal moves, just running down the line. And now we have, like, 14 idols per episode. So I think roughly. What was the number you gave before? 14 quadrillion? That's what we have.
Exactly. That many idols.
So in terms of, like, we talk about the major flips, and this is coming back to some of the moves we've talked about in the game theory series before, talked about Penna. Someone like Cochran, how does Nash Equilibrium work into him flipping at the merge? How does that happen?
Okay, so, and by the way, again, I want to emphasize that I'm being a little sloppy in terms of Equilibrium and sort of talking about Nash Equilibrium in terms of a series of moves as opposed to one.
Jason will forgive you.
But, yes, exactly. So when that merge happens, Cochran has a couple of utilities that he's considering. He's increasing increased odds of winning the game, plus the increased utility from being with people who are kind to him, who accept him, who pump up his ego. And given the experience he's had, his marginal utility for those things is suddenly very high. He has not gotten a lot of positive feedback, and it becomes a lot more valuable. So if you assume for the moment that he's not necessarily trying to increase his odds of winning $1 million, that he's trying to increase his odds of getting that utility of the positive feedback, then if he sticks with his tribe, if he keeps that same strategy that he's had in the previous rounds, he does not increase his odds of getting that positive feedback and that sense of belonging. But by flipping, he does. He does better. He gets better results for himself by the scoring measurement that he's given himself, consciously or unconsciously. So, the game at that point is in a state of disequilibrium. So it's pretty predictable, given that we know that Cochran will flip. But once he has flipped, then at that point, Coach's Alliance has the majority. It is in all of their advantage to stick with that majority. And given that they're going to do that, there is no different move the minority can make to increase their odds of winning the game. So from that point on, after that one moment of disequilibrium, the game is in a state of equilibrium. And we would expect it to play out as it does, where round after round, people are going to be making essentially the same strategic choice until one tribe is entirely gone.
And I think we can look at that, you know, the utilities thing, I think, is a very big takeaway from this podcast, because you can look at it like, is there utils for Cochran there? Is there value there that someone who has suffered through a pre-merge will find a home, a happy home there against Savai'i and Onupolu? You probably say yes, because of the psychological aspect of the game. Or you can look at it as that is useless. He had a way better chance of, or a better chance at least, of winning the actual game if he stuck with Savai'i, and that's the only lens we tend to look at it, that I've analyzed it through on multiple podcasts. And Coach is manipulating what he knows to be important to Cochran without it actually having any actual value. But then, as you say, if it's just important to you, that has value too. So there is some validity there. But again, as super fans, we, and myself completely included, we do tend to look at it just based on, you know, what were your odds of winning the game before this and what are they now?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of times when we do take that extra step of thinking, okay, what are people's values beyond the game? We often think of it as a fixed thing. We say, okay, it was a great move by Coach to see that Cochran was in this state of needing this extra thing. But I think it's also worth acknowledging another great move, which is essentially manipulating somebody's marginal utility by giving them lots of something. And I'm thinking about Jeremy's phrase of surround and drown, where, and this is actually something that Coach was doing, was he gave his group this incredible feeling of belonging. And ultimately, I think he paid the price for that because people felt betrayed. But because he gave people, he felt had so much belonging. They had belonging up the wazoo. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have an incentive to get it from somebody else. So you can actually manipulate people's marginal utility of belonging, of pride, of honor, by letting them feel like they have a huge amount of it from you. So even if somebody else offers them some, it becomes worth much less to them.
I'm trying to think of what it would be like to go back to 2009 and tell myself, like, what a big character on the Game Theory series Coach would end up being based on the person he was in Token Tears. Because so many of these things and the psychological parts as well really do feed into some stuff that Coach was doing. There was some good stuff there. Again, don't tell Coach that, but there was.
Sorry, I just tweeted Coach and Johnny Fairplay, invited them to your next Game Theory podcast. I hope that's okay. They said yes.
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted you to do. And we were talking a few days ago, and you said something interesting that I thought we could touch on a bit. of the ideas of a state of chaos actually being Nash equilibrium because everything's so chaotic that the thing you expect to happen is flipping. And there definitely are seasons of Survivor where if it had, you know, if you flip every single time, again, I can think about Survivor South African Champions is a good one, but there's more than that. Pearl Islands is a good example as well, where there was so much going on, Amazon as well. Kagiyan definitely had a flip and non-flip structure where if there'd been too many rounds in a row of like a begonging after all the flipping, that would have felt like a departure from what felt like the correct equilibrium of the time.
Yes, absolutely. And so the game theory vocabulary here that I would bring in is pure strategy versus mixed strategy. So a pure strategy is where, so sometimes with game theory, we're talking about a single round of play. Like you and I are going to drive our cars at each other once, and then what happens, and then we both go.
That? No more driving our cars at each other. Between that and Mike, like I'm not having a fun time with you guys.
Okay, so you and I are going to buy each other a random amount of pie, and we'll do it once.
Okay,
and then we'll go home. So we can drive our cars at each other. Okay, so we can drive our cars to the pie takeout. How about that? Mm-hmm. We'll compromise. So a pure strategy is where whatever game you're playing, you're going to do the same thing every time, where it's always in your interest to do that same thing. So if you're playing the Mike Bloom Biostrath water game, it's always in your interest to make the same move. That's called a pure strategy. If you do that 100 times, you will do the same thing 100 times. But actually, just to move this away from cars, let's move this to the stock market. Whereas if you're buying stocks, in a sense, each time you buy a stock, you're making a move in this long-term investing game. And in that case, you want to have a mixed strategy. You're going to buy some stocks that are really safe, but won't make you a lot of money. And you'll probably have a few risky bets in your portfolio. So a mixed strategy is where you have a portfolio of moves. And depending on the round, you do different moves. And maybe you have a specific move really in terms of like the external situation. Or maybe you're just flipping a coin. Maybe just one out of every three times you're buying that riskier stock. And so I would say somebody like Tony in Cagayan, it seems like he's crazy. He's all over the place. He's switching. He's not switching. But he actually has a pretty consistent strategy if you look at it as a portfolio of moves that he will flip, then he'll go back to his alliance. Then he'll flip, then he'll go back to his alliance. So in a sense, you could say he's got, it is a consistent strategy. It is just a mixed strategy. And so in a sense, you could argue that if he's doing the same strategy every time, as crazy as the game seems, it is in a sense of equilibrium because he's doing his strategy every time and everybody else is trying to do the best they can given this crazy strategy that he's doing.
Yeah, the pattern was really clear after the fact. I think the problem with being Tony's victim is it's not clear in the moment, and it does feel like these individual yes. rounds. But maybe to Tony, they probably were individual rounds. I don't think he was thinking like, all right, I'm going to flip and then go back. And I don't think he was necessarily thinking that, but like looking back at it, it definitely was like a pretty consistent strategy, even though it was very messy in the consistency.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, there's Christian Hubicki is somebody who sort of has explicitly talked about this, where his strategy was to sow chaos to some degree to make the game move quickly because he felt he was better qualified to take advantage of it than other people. So in that chaos, there can be a consistent strategy.
Yeah, so let's move on to games with multiple equilibriums, which is definitely connected to that and that it has the word equilibrium, so I'm sure they're connected. Also, I'm sure I've used that word incorrectly like multiple times on this podcast. I'm just saying things. This is way above my pay grade, guys. I'm trying my best. Explain that to the listeners.
Okay, so let me give you, and this will be the long-awaited positive game that you were hoping for. So assume that
you
and your
husband sign up for all these games, but I'm winning, right?
Yeah, you're doing a superb job so far. I've been very impressed, and I think you'll be good at this game too.
Okay.
So assume that you and your husband are going to have a date night.
Okay. Oh my god! So, is he going to try and give me Biostrath again, like with the water? These are not fun dates.
Okay, I'm going to let you choose the dates. Tell me a date that you would enjoy, that both of you would enjoy, but you would enjoy more, and then a date that both of you would enjoy, but your husband would enjoy more.
I think I would enjoy seeing a rom-com. He'd see a movie, but not necessarily a rom-com. And he would enjoy bowling more than me because I'm not very good at bowling. I don't like playing games that I can't win, clearly. So, yeah, he's good at bowling.
Okay, so here's the game we're going to play. It's called Date Night. And you have to choose whether you're going to the bowling alley or the movie, which is the movie theater, which is showing the latest rom-com that you want to see. So if you think about it, this is a variable sum game, right? There's outcomes that are better for both of you. Like if you both go to the bowling alley or you both go to the movie theater, that's pretty good. Whereas if you go to the movie theater and he goes to the bowling alley, assuming that the point of date night is spend time together, you're both less happy than if you're at the same place. And the absolute worst scenario is where you go to the bowling alley and he goes to the movie theater and then nobody's happy. Mm-hmm. So there's variable sum. Right? You can, so in a variable sum game, there is the opportunity for compromise and working together. So what would you say is the state of Nash equilibrium, the strategy or strategies in which both of you are doing as well as you can, given what the other person's doing?
I guess to just compromise and go with one of them, but which one?
Okay, well, so you're exactly right, because what makes this tough is there's two Nash equilibriums. There's one, like, if you both go to the movie theater, right? Once you know that he's going to the movie theater, you cannot do any better by going to the bowling alley. And he can't do better by going to the bowling alley if you're at the movie theater. So that's one state of equilibrium. But if you are both going to the bowling alley, then neither of you can do better by just going on your own to the movie theater. So there's two different states of equilibrium. And what's interesting here is that although there's two states of equilibrium, each of you prefers one. So how do you make sure that you both end up in the same place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so So here's an easy way. Maybe you have a rule that like every other week, one of you gets to choose, right? So the first and the third week of the month, you go to the bowling alley. The second and the fourth week of the month, you go to the movie theater. And now you have this external thing where neither of you is really deciding yourself. You're just making a decision based on this external thing you've agreed on. And in theory, you know, you still have free will. If it's bowling alley night, you could just go to a movie on your own, but you will probably end up less happy because the whole point is to spend time with your husband.
I guess it would depend on how good the movie is. That would be, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. So now it actually gets complicated because now he's going to sort of like figure out your utility for like, okay, a Hugh Jackman romantic comedy versus somebody else. So
How high is the score on Rotten Tomatoes will be how much I stick with that plan.
Okay, exactly. There you go. But assuming a constant level of tomatoometer, this external thing, this calendar that you're both referring to, lets you both optimize. So you are both happier because that means every single date night you both are together, as opposed to some other strategy where you're not coordinating and you're just trying to figure it out on your own. So this is called a correlated equilibrium. And you get that sometimes in a situation where it's a variable sum game, so you can benefit by cooperating. I'll give you another example. And this is the car crash game, the chicken, but there's a good outcome, which is this time we have a friend in the audience who's going to signal to us whose turn it is to swerve. And we just basically take turns swerving. And that way we each get to look cool half the time to our friends, but we neither of us dies in a fiery car crash.
That's good.
So you can have the situation where there's an incentive to go to this external thing. But, and here's something important. You have to believe that that external thing has your best interests at heart. So, like, if I realize that the friend in the audience at the chicken game wants to kill me, I'm not going to do what he says, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to bring this to something more Survivor-related, so I'm only four episodes into Survivor South Africa Champions, but one of the interesting things from a game theory perspective is that because you have these non-playing captains, in theory, that is the perfect setup for a correlated equilibrium. That is the perfect external thing that all the players can refer to. You know, we could have it in a theory, you could have a situation where that they could signal who's getting voted out, and then everybody benefits from moving forward in a unified way. But if you're an individual player and you don't think that coach has your best interest at heart, you will not refer to that external correlation. You will not take that signal. And if you aren't making a move based on that signal, suddenly the whole thing falls apart because it's not in anybody else's advantage to refer to that signal as well.
Right. So that's a lot. So I'm going to try and lay the term down even more so.
Yes.
As someone who's also just been learning about this stuff. So this is an external device to change your calculation of the odds. So in Survivor, there are these signals that exist where we can say, all right, well, okay, I have a pathway. Work with this person or not work with this person. It's two different ways. And there are ways that you can know, all right, my person in the audience is some sort of connection that we have. And we see it all the time. We see demographic alliances. This person's from the same place as me. This person is a woman and there's more women on the tribe, usually more men on the tribe. But people tend to cling to these signals. They don't have to, and they might not trust it. And there might be other things that turn them away from that and then it collapses. But often there is this external thing that points you towards one path.
That's exactly it. And those things of like, you know, we're both women, we're both Southerners, whatever it is a great example, because it often, from an outsider, that seems sort of crazy that like $1 million are at stake and you're trusting somebody based on the fact that you both come from Tennessee. It makes no sense. But you're so desperate at that point for some way of correlating your strategy that these external things start seeming attractive. And it is, in a sense, rational, because if you believe in Southern honor, even if I don't, if you believe in it, and I think you believe in it, I think you're more likely to stick to your word because you believe in it. And that makes me more likely to trust you. And that makes me more likely to stick to my word. And so we both benefit rationally from referring to this crazy, irrational, external thing that shouldn't seem like it matters.
Yeah, and I think it all does come down to you're reading that person in the audience who's telling you to swerve or not to swerve. If your read is correct, then you're going to do the right thing. It's the same thing here. If your read is correct that is something that can connect you and create more trust, then it's going to be a beneficial relationship for both of you.
Absolutely. Oh, and you know, another example that where Survivor does this, I think, more successfully than the team captains is where you have the theme tribe divisions. You have heroes versus healers versus hustlers. You have brain versus brawn versus beauty. Within that tribe, you can often get people to coordinate their actions by pointing just to the tribe name and saying, well, I'm going to do this because I'm a brain and this is what brains do. I'm going to stick to my word because I'm blue collar and this is what blue collar does. And as long as you believe that I believe it, then it becomes in your interest to act on it, no matter how silly and arbitrary that tribe name seems.
And correlated equilibrium, I think what you're trying to do here is collaborate, right? Like in date night, I'm not trying to get one over on my husband. I'm trying to work with him so that we can have the best date night possible and keep us both fairly happy, right? And I think that often on Survivor, as we've said, the rounds themselves are variable sum games. There's a lot of reason to be working with people. You have to work with people in the game of Survivor. So this does create a way for you to collaborate with each other without one of you having that much power over the other to the point where we would go to the movie every single time. Like here, where there's even taken that trust because you found an external factor that has helped you kind of set that up to both of your mutual benefit.
That's right. But you know, sometimes in Survivor and perhaps in relationships, it's not always, you don't always just want to share the benefit. You want to increase your own benefit.
Right. This is the portion of the podcast about manipulating your loved ones. Everyone, we got there. It was weird.
Exactly. Yes, we're finally there. So this comes back. And when I was sort of thinking about what we're going to talk about, I didn't realize how often I was going to talk about you and me driving our cars at each other. But I've got to come back to that. I feel like I have now amended to being like,
we work out how to analyze Survivor, how to play Survivor, how to manipulate your loved ones, and how to not die in a fiery car crash. That's the fourth one of those things, and I didn't realize that.
Exactly. There's just so much you can take away from this. So, given that when we're driving at each other, there's two Nash equilibriums, right? One is where I swerve and you go straight, and the other is where you swerve and I go straight. And certainly, either of those states, I prefer to the one where we crash, but I very much prefer the one where you swerve, because then I look cool. And you know, if there's one thing that
I've
you know
never
about
thought
that,
about looking cool in a swerving contest, but okay, this seems to be a big part of game theory, so it's good to know.
Yes, exactly. And you know, if you're going to judge me from my moves, clearly somebody who goes on a Survivor podcast to talk about game theory is really concerned about being a cool guy. So you know that's a driving utility for me.
Yes, definitely.
So I want to force us into that state of Nash equilibrium where I drive straight and you swerve. So what I do is I glue my steering wheel in place. And not only that, I make sure you see me gluing it in place, because this is crucial. You have to know that I'm committed to driving straight. And once you know I can only drive straight, every single time, assuming you're rational, you will swerve, because that's the only state of Nash equilibrium that is now left to you. I've just closed off another path that leads to equilibrium, and the one where I win every time is now open.
Right. So if I wanted to manipulate my loved ones, not just not die in a fiery crash, I would go to the movie and I would say, turning off my phone, I'm sitting in the seat, I'm having date night here tonight. And if you want date night, I'm here. Like, I forced that from you.
That's exactly right. And so, again, this is assuming that there is no utility in, like, sort of trust and repeated cooperation.
I want to see that movie.
I understand. You've got your priorities on straight. I think in Survivor, a real world example of this is Ben playing his idol before the vote. Because you can imagine if he doesn't do that, then there's one equilibrium state where everybody votes for him unanimously and he plays his idol and he stays, but the opposing alliance stays intact. So he's hoping by playing it early, he's forcing them into the state, the other equilibrium state, where a couple of them gang up on two or three people and the alliance fractures.
Yeah.
So he has committed himself by playing the idol.
Yeah, and he loses something from there. He loses the power of surprise and ability to blindside people. But what he has done is force change in the others, because that's what this is about. It was kind of breaking the game. He shouldn't have been able to do it. But by creating the system where he's 100% driving straight, he's forcing everyone else to swerve. Literally, that is exactly what he was doing. So he was also probably thinking about the fiery car crash a lot. But I was thinking about forcing commitment on Survivor because I think it's a really interesting one. You want to get your way, but you have very little to do that with. Like, you basically have the clothes on your back. And as I was thinking that, I was thinking, people do this with the clothes on their back. Like, I remember Shawnee saying that she didn't think that Brooke would vote her out in Australian Survivor All-Stars because she was wearing Brooke's dress. That's commitment. It's like, I'm in this dress right now. If you vote me out, you lose your clothes. And we don't have a lot of clothes, and you might want this dress. So I think that there's a lot of good examples of how people just kind of create that thing as this, like, forced, immovable object, and they have to make everyone else work around it.
That's great. Yeah, I love that example. And there's also, I think that in towards the end of Game Changers, Brad Culpepper and Sarah exchanged jewelry. Like, Culpepper gave her, I think, his wedding ring,
yes.
And she gave
Why
him
did he agree to that?
Some, like, random necklace she didn't care about.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I guess, but it's clearly, like, I mean, I guess the only reason he agrees to that is because he really, truly plans on sticking to his word and taking it to the end. So, I mean, that's a pretty good form of commitment.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things here that you can do. I mean, Survivor is a social game. So I think you don't want to be, like, basically forcing people into doing something, because the next time they're going to be pissed off at you, or you might want them to vote for you in the jury. Like, that's why you can't be so heavy-handed that you just sit down in the movie theater. You want to go with that correlated equilibrium, have some mutual benefit there, and really work together. But if you want to force this here, which I think is definitely, like, the bad cop route, then there are ways to do it. Like, you could, in terms of the same movie theater idea, I'm just here, I'm sitting down, like, you can, at the, like, we talk about this, it happens often, it's something that Tony actually does, is to say, I've come 5 minutes before tribal council, this is my vote. There's not enough time for me to change it, this is it, and now you know, and now it's like, are you going to waste your vote, or are you going to go with that plan? Because you know what he's doing, he's not moving, he's driving forward. Are you going with that? Because that seems like it's your only choice.
What's sort of crucial about that example of Tony going right before tribal council is the timing of it, because if he goes too soon, it's almost like I'm gluing my steering wheel, but you see that the glue isn't that strong, that I actually can change it if I want. So a crucial part of this commitment is really making people believe you are truly committed. And actually thinking about one of the advantages of the way Culpepper did it with giving his ring, to your point about wanting to build trust and not piss people off, he wasn't sort of forcing her into a particular path so much as forcing himself into a particular path.
Well, I think that move was Sarah's move. Like, she took the ring more than he gave it, I see. So she was forcing him. But yes, he agreed to be forced himself into that plan.
Okay, yeah. So I guess it depends on who makes that move. Who's gluing? There's a difference between gluing your steering wheel and gluing somebody else's steering wheel. And from game theory, there might not be, but in terms of that sort of social dynamics, there certainly is for that repeated game in the next round.
Yeah. So how much does this help your chances in a world in which the social game doesn't matter and you could do this every time? You could go at the right before tribal council every single time before it's like you're not allowed to speak and be like, these are the votes, and everyone would just have to do it. It wouldn't work because they would hate you forever and you wouldn't last very long, but they can do it. But also, people don't have to go with your plans, right? Like, Brooke can still vote out Shawnee and just give up on her dress. Like, an example that I think about is Lisa in Survivor New Zealand Thailand votes out Matt at the final six. He has an idol that they found together. It's technically, you know, it's technically both of their idols. If he wins the next immunity, he's probably playing it on her. You would think that that was like a forced commitment of like, I have this thing and it's keeping us together, maybe against your will, but she'd rather give up on the idol than have him in the game. So there's a chance that people don't go with it. I mean, Brad can give up his wedding ring.
He absolutely can. And this comes back to one of the basic assumptions of game theory, which is that if I'm doing backwards induction and I think that I've put you in a position where you have no choice but to make a certain decision, that's assuming I know the point value you get from each activity. But as we've discussed, people get utility out of different things. And so if I've miscalculated your utility, if you get more utility out of being independent and screwing me over than you do from advancing your odds in the game, then my committing myself or forcing you into commitment doesn't help, because you actually will take the path that I think is irrational. And, you know, we see this a lot where people think the other player has no choice but to go with them, but they sink themselves and the strategist because they're getting utility out of independence or something else.
Yeah, it's funny how much this forced commitment is based on the extra utility of Love Survivor that can exist. Like, you would think, again, you're in a game for $1 million, it's the only thing that matters, but also you care about your wedding ring, you care about the clothes on your back, you care about being warm tonight, and that can matter as well. So utility, I think, has been like the word, utils has been like the word of the podcast. Probably also equilibrium, probably also car crash, fiery car crash, and biostrap and the chizzy. But yeah, I think that's been like a really big part of how you can really use this in Survivor, is to just work out what is important to people and then to exploit that.
Exactly right. In Survivor, in life, and in massive global conflicts.
Yes, and fiery car crashes. So with a chizzy, exactly. Let's go back. So how are you saying that people can work together in the chizzy to their mutual benefit?
Oh, okay. So if you imagine a situation where you and I are on Survivor South Africa, mm-hmm. You, me, and Mike Blue, and
I don't want to work with Mike anymore. Point, he's a bad host.
Perfect. Well, that's why I'm glad I'm with you and him, because you and I are going to team up to maximize our chizzy points, right? Like, if it's totally random, then sometimes Mike will get those three chizzy points. But what you and I want to do is have a situation where you and I always, one of us, you or me, will always get those three chizzy points, or six chizzy points, really, if we get three from both people. So this is a perfect case for correlated equilibrium, where we agree that this episode is your turn to make the best move, and I'll make the second best move, and then you get the 3 points and I get two. And then next time, it's my turn to make the three and your turn to get the two. And we have some sort of external thing we're both pointing to. We can have a state of correlated equilibrium where we're taking turns. We're saying, you know, the even numbered episodes, you do something, and the odd numbered episodes, I do something. So by doing this, we both do better than we would if we left it up to chance and sometimes let that jerk Mike Bloom get some of the 3-point scores.
If anyone ever does that and games the chizzy because they got to the end of this mathematical game theory principles podcast, they will auto win the chizzy. So I already did it for you. You guys didn't need to work so hard. Just by even saying that, you won. I want to live in that world.
Congratulations to whoever is that mega chitty winner.
Well, this has been in depth. I think that we've talked about a lot of interesting things. I hope people were keeping up with it. I think I was mostly keeping up with it, but it is a lot. Is there any other game theory, mathematical principles that you want to share with the listeners? Or are we going to just let them sit with this for a moment and think about how they're going to use math to win Survivor one day?
I think we've covered it pretty thoroughly. I mean, you know, game theory is this huge, rich field, and if you know a lot about it, I'm sure you feel I've simplified things. But I think we've done a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it can sound pretty complicated, but hopefully by giving like real world Survivor examples, again, this is why you learn math with Survivor. If you think about the examples, you're like, oh, okay, so that's what that is, and just like, you know, connect those two things. I think that's how we did it. I think that's how they should teach math in schools.
I agree completely.
If that's what they were doing, I never would have dropped math. I just would have been like, all right, Survivor examples only. And I would have kept doing it. But I don't think that's exactly what they were teaching, to be fair.
But you know, arguably, you should teach everything by Survivor.
I completely agree. Well, thank you so much, Jacob, for coming on and teaching us math and teaching us so much more about Survivor that we can see the game a different way. I definitely am looking at it differently. I'm already analyzing Survivor South Africa Champions differently, as I said, since we started talking about it. So I know it's something that must be really relevant and will be relevant to my analysis going forward. Where can the listeners find you? And, you know, as you said, inviting all the criticism, which is something that you did on this podcast.
Yes. Okay. So if you want any criticism, my address is a real Mike Bloom type on Twitter. So I'm on social media. I'm mostly on Twitter. That's Jacob SW, JACOBSW. If you're in your local bookstore, you can look for my books. My most recent one is How to Remember Everything: Tips and Tricks to Become a Memory Master. So keep an eye out for that as well.
I think we know what that is. Just use Survivor examples. That must be it,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. There's a section in there on how to memorize an entire deck of cards. And the technique you do is you assign each card a face of somebody you know, because it's much easier to remember a human face than a card. And so initially, I had like half of my examples were Survivor. I was like, okay, so the Ace of Diamonds is Sandra Diaz-Twine, and the Two of Spades is Yao Man Chan. Mm-hmm. And my editor was like, you know, I think we want our book to be more accessible to people who don't know Survivor. So sadly, that is no longer there. But
what would be the
point?
If
you read the book, you can know it's supposed to be there.
I use Survivor in memory all the time. Like, we were just at a water park a couple of weeks ago, and our locker number was 1134. I remember that because I was like, all right, Danny, Sarah, let's go. That's how I did it. Like, that's way more memorable to me than some numbers.
That's great. That's a fantastic memory technique. Well, this is another topic, but yes, a classic memory technique is to take something that you already know and link this new thing you want to remember into it. So you are doing that perfectly.
Well, but most people would say, but then you have to remember all the Survivor winners, but obviously as super fans, that's something we know. So yeah, I mean, this is what it's like to be married to me. It's not a fun time, and I will just sit in that movie theater and you can do what you want. So that's the kind of person that I am. But you're like writing books and you write out theme songs and then you know you're a math genius. Like, you're doing it all.
Thank you. Not a genius, but thank you.
Yes,
I don't know what to say beyond that.
No, thank you so much for teaching us on this podcast. You guys can follow me at Shannon Gates. Please subscribe to the International Survivor Hap-Ups feed, where you will get all these off-season game theory podcasts. This is, I think, our fifth one. We did the social game with Harriet Heels. We did the much-referenced psychological principles with Dr. Amanda Rabinowitz, which was super fun. And then with Taryn Armstrong, we have done the history of the flip and plurality vote. So they're all kind of working in with each other in this, like, very nerdy, way too intensive analysis of Survivor, but I'm really enjoying it. And that feed also has all the Survivor South Africa Champions recaps that we're doing every week, finishing up next week. And then Survivor South Africa Season 8 is coming in June, in just over 2 months. So very exciting stuff happening. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you so much, Jacob, again for being here. Thank you to Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes, and we will see you next time. Bye.
Australian Survivor.
21 South Africans.
12 ordinary Australians.
16 New Zealanders.
1 million pounds.
Million euro.
Million.
Million.
Tribe.
Tribe.
Tribe.